This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary, and we're meeting on April 30th, 1987 at 3 o'clock p.m. in Hearing Room 343. This will be a public hearing on Senate Bills 138, 154, 631, 733, 793, 870, 915, and 1016, as well as House Bill 2298.
Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senators Wires and Fryer here as a subcommittee to take public testimony on Senate Bill 631. Lee Hockman, you're sitting up here, and we've got John Gilmore and Jeffrey Davis with you. Is that who's there?
Yes.
All right, gentlemen, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am Jeff Davis with Marion County Health Department and here representing the Mental Health Directors Association. Our testimony today with regards to Senate Bill 31 is in relation to the proposed amendments that are before you titled SB 631-1, and I will stop at this point and turn it over to Lee Hockman.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, for some time the local community mental health programs have been working on approaches in dealing with the emergency hospitalization of mental health clients in the local communities. This process is a dual responsibility both by the mental health division and the local community mental health programs. We've had some problems in various communities because of the lack of controls on cost. This bill, as proposed to be amended, would do really three things. One, it would help control where the emergency mental ill clients are admitted and allow for contractual agreements between the hospitals and the local community mental health programs. It would also keep hospitals from billing and being reimbursed for unrelated and sometimes unneeded services to the local mental health programs. And third, it should establish an equitable source of last resort reimbursement rate based upon reasonable cost. Although the legislation will not offset cost increases in other mental health areas, it is a cost reduction effort which will allow limited treatment funds to be used for direct mental health care in the local communities. We would appreciate your consideration.
All right. Any other comments by either of you two gentlemen? All right. Senator Wires, any questions?
No questions.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. We have one other witness sign up, Barry Cast.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Barry Cast. I'm here representing Joseph Murray, Administrator of the Mental Health Division. We lend support to the bill with the amendments that have been drafted by legislative counsel. We feel strongly that these costs must be brought under control, and we feel that administrative rule is the proper procedure to do so. We have submitted testimony from Mr. Murray, which sets forth these amendments and our justification for them. I have nothing further to add.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Ware, any questions?
No.
All right. That'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 631. We could go ahead with this. You want to go ahead with the same?
Whatever you want to do? Sure, yeah. Good idea.
All right. Now, with reference to Senate Bill 915, bring me the sign up sheet on 915, please. I'm the only one in the building, apparently, that's got a copy of this major amendment to this bill, and I was kind of waiting until the other committee members had a chance to get that, but we're going to proceed with testimony on Senate Bill 915 anyway. Okay, now, Don McClay, were you going to be the first witness? Or?
Yes.
All right, fine. You come on up.
915.
Well, thank you very much for letting, the courtesy of letting us go first. We do have a problem that requires that does not allow us to sit here for 2 hours waiting.
You don't have a luxury of a lot of time like people serving the legislature.
Exactly.
Is that what you're
saying? No, not indeed. We have a physical problem, and I appreciate your thoughtfulness. Senator Fry, and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Donald S. McClave. I am the father of Susan McClave, one of seven students and two faculty members from the Oregon Episcopal School who perished while climbing Mount Hood last May. With me this afternoon, lending their moral support, are Brenton Clark on my left and Giles Thompson, who are the only survivors of what was the worst accident ever on Mount Hood and one of the worst mountaineering tragedies of all time anywhere in North America. We are here along with representatives of Oregon's entire mountain rescue community and on behalf of the thousands upon thousands of climbers throughout the world whose eyes are upon us in this hearing room today. The bill which Senator Simmons has introduced and with the amendments that have been added to it, Senate Bill 915, will revolutionize mountain rescue and save countless lives in the future. We are here to support that effort. To illustrate why this bill is so important, let me describe for you the circumstances of last year's accident. The climbing party, which Brenton, Giles, and my daughter Susan were part of, left Timberline Lodge early on the morning of May 12, 1986, on a climb to the summit of Mount Hood. Late that afternoon, they were trapped by a severe blizzard while attempting to descend from the upper level of the mountain. After becoming lost, they prudently elected to seek shelter for the night in a snow cave some 2,000 feet above the lodge. Now, the average spring storm on Mount Hood lasts for about 6 to 8 hours, but this was not an ordinary storm. It was, in fact, one of terrible intensity, and it lasted for more than 30 hours after it began on the afternoon of May 12. When I arrived at Mount Hood on the morning of May 13, rescue operations were already underway in spite of the incredibly difficult conditions. Snowcat drivers were transporting climbers up the mountain in zero visibility to the estimated location of the cave. And on several occasions, they actually dropped off rescuers within a few hundred feet of the stranded climbers. But it was impossible to see or hear anything because of the storm. Finally, on the evening of May 13, the storm ended, and rescuers searched all night long using flashlights, flares, and headlights from the snowcats. But by then, the cave had been covered over by drifting snow and couldn't be located. When daybreak came on May 14, clear skies allowed the use of rescue helicopters, and within 20 minutes or so, the bodies of three victims were found lying in the snow. Now, as it happened, they were within just a few feet of the entrance to the cave, but there was no way to know that at the time. On May 15, just a few minutes before the scheduled 6 p.m. cessation of search activities, an exhausted rescuer pushed his probe into the snow one last time and located the cave. Brenton and Giles were saved, thank God. But after 3 days in the snow, it was too late for anyone else. The rescuers had run out of time. It seems appropriate at this point to acknowledge the heroic effort which was made by the rescue groups. They worked incessantly for nearly 60 hours to locate the climbers, often at peril to their own safety. Everything that could possibly have been done was done, and I'll always be grateful to the rescue groups for that. Next, I'd like to comment on the cause of the accident, as determined by an independent investigation board and summarized in the report which has been distributed to you. The board concluded that the primary cause of the accident was the failure of the climb leadership to turn back at an earlier hour when the group's energy reserves would have been greater. And I make this point not to condemn the climb leader, Father Thomas Goman, but rather to point out that even climbers as experienced and careful as Tom had been over 25 years of climbing sometimes make mistakes or become ill. It has happened many times in the past, and unfortunately, it will happen again in the future. Signal devices often give climbers a second chance under these circumstances. And although they are not a panacea for every possible problem which can arise during a climb, signal devices of the type which are going to be described for you in a few moments can save lives by helping rescuers locate stranded climbers much, much faster. 9 lives would have been saved last May if these devices had been available, as would countless others in previous accidents over the years. The good news is that you can act here in this room today to save the lives of the climbers who will become stranded in Oregon's mountains in the future. Dick Konstam and Dave Hitchcock are going to tell you about the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund and the electronic signal devices which can prevent a reoccurrence of last year's disaster. Craig Petrie, who is co-chairman of the Mountain Signal Memorial Fund, perhaps said it best in a recent interview with Sports Illustrated magazine, and I quote, "It's ironic. We have the technology to see people in Red Square from outer space and to track caribou from thousands of miles away, but we don't have an effective system for finding someone who is lost in the woods," end quote. Please, please stop this senseless situation from continuing any longer. Please vote yes on Senate Bill 915 and let Oregon lead the way in allowing sophisticated technology to save lives in our mountains. On behalf of Brenton and Giles and myself, I thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I would be pleased to answer any questions which you might have.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Senator Hanby? Senator Wires?
It's nice to meet you folks, though. We all, I'm sure everybody in this room read about the tragedy and followed it and hoped that more people would survive, and we're glad that at least two did. Kind of heroes, and we read about you, and glad you made it. I climbed Mount Hood once and fell in the chute coming down the north face of Mount Hood and slid partway down and a rope. There were 4 of us roped in, and we managed to stop partly by luck. But there was nothing like what this was. We didn't have any snow on us or anything.
Okay, Don, thanks again. Thank you,
Senator. We appreciate your courtesy in letting us go first.
All right. I would suggest, unless you have a different idea, Don, that I call, Senator Simmons, did you want to say anything?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Come ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I introduced this bill at the request of the people who are appearing here today for several reasons. One, I have been involved in mountain rescue for a good many years and can appreciate the problems that they have faced and that the rescuers have faced. I tried to bring a bill with the amendments that can be an appropriate one for the purpose and which will also pass the constitutional questions of the limitation of liability. I have met many times with people who have this interest and are expressing it today. I think they can better express the details than I can. My only thought is that I know from personal experience what it is to find a body on a mountain, to know that I have walked or skied by that same place during the night and missed it when there was still a chance to have saved a life. I think that if this bill can save one life, of course, it will be very worthwhile. And I would solicit your support of the bill. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to ask or to answer.
Any questions of Senator Simmons?
Senator Hamby.
Chair, yes. Senator, are the amendments that you spoke to Stephen Kefauri amendments dated April 30?
Yes, those are the ones that were prepared by Randall Kester, who is a former member of the Supreme Court of Oregon and has long been interested in mountain rescue and mountain safety.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Senator, for being here.
Thank you.
All right, Randall Kester. Yeah, all right, Judge, whatever you say. Have him come up.
My name is Dick Constam, and I've been operator of Timberline Lodge for 31 years. In fact, I start my 32nd year tomorrow. During these past 31 years, I've been witness to many mountain climbing accidents. In the time since records have been kept, 50 wilderness fatalities have been associated with Mount Hood. Of the many, many searches and rescues that have ended up on a less severe note, one aspect that has always been strikingly apparent is the great anguish on the part of friends and relatives who stand and wait for the news. Not a year goes by without some search and rescue on the mountain, and you must remember that the searchers are often putting their lives in jeopardy also. Often, too, these searches take days and days to carry out. Following this last and most severe mountain tragedy, I was quoted on local television as asking for the implementation of a locating device that could quickly and easily pinpoint lost climbers. Simultaneously with this, and almost miraculously, a group of experienced and hardened mountain people came together and said we must formulate a system and find a tool specifically for the purpose of locating those who are lost. This ad hoc committee later came to be called the Mountain Signal Memorial Group. Money was meanwhile starting to pour in from such diverse sources as private corporations, church groups, youth groups, bank employees, car clubs, schools, artist workshops, and the scouts, just to name a few. The newly formed citizen group was composed of people from the county sheriff's office, the 304th Air Rescue Squadron, Portland Mountain Rescue, a ski area on Mount Hood, the Mazamas, the Mount Hood Ski Patrol, the U.S. Forest Service, the State Emergency Management Division, and from one U.S. Senator's office and one Congressman's office. With this deep concern from the mountain community, the focus was definitely on some form of locating beacon. I should mention here that the Mountain Signal Group was formally meeting as early as May 19th, within the same week that the climbing tragedy had occurred. One of the first items on the agenda was to make inquiries both by phone and by mail throughout the world in an effort to find out what others had discovered in the realm of tracking devices. We canvassed Scandinavia, the Alps, Australia, New Zealand in particular, and we set up testing criteria and began systematically examining and testing different devices as they arrived from everywhere. It must be pointed out here that the Mountain Signal Group has no intent whatsoever to make the wearing or carrying of a signal device obligatory. Think of it, as you will, as a flashlight on a camping trip. If you go camping, you should know how to build a campfire or pitch a tent. And learning to be a good camper is probably the most important thing. But if you have any sense at all and are camping overnight, you'll probably take a flashlight. In this day and age of electronic wizardry, it's easy to carry along a lightweight locating device on a potentially dangerous trip, much like a flashlight on a camping trip. As the weeks slipped into months, our search went on, but we got the first inkling of what we wanted from a correspondent in New Zealand who told us of a device the search and rescue division in their country, country's Department of Transportation, had been using. A similar equipment setup, we were told, was being formulated and manufactured in the state of Arizona. At the same time all this research was going on, there were subcommittees working on fundraising, methodology, implementation, and the legal and liability aspects of locating devices. We soon realized that whales can be tracked in the Bering Sea, but that a couple of lost mushroom hunters in Oak Ridge, Oregon, cannot be found. The reason we can't find these folks is not that we don't have the technology, because we do, but rather that a problem exists regarding the legal ramifications for the manufacturers and the distributors of devices and for the searchers themselves. I can tell you that it caused me utmost anxiety to order employees out on a stormy winter night to go look for lost skiers or climbers, knowing that I may endanger their lives as well. Those who risk their lives every year on the mountain must be able to have the best electronic locating equipment possible. But the manufacturers of this best equipment will not allow it to be used to locate people, because of the possibilities of lawsuits, which is why they have stayed with the animal population. We are asking you to give Senate Bill 915 your long and hard consideration. It would provide an exemption from liability for devices and personnel used in the performance of such rescue operations in Oregon. We ask you also to bear in mind the tremendous outpouring of energy and effort, which I have just described for you, by citizens trying to avert a further unnecessary tragedy, has cost the state nothing. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Wires.
Does this amendment that we're going to be getting, I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Is this amendment that we're going to be getting copies, is that going to substitute the whole act, or is it just add on to it?
My understanding is that this amendment is going to be a substitute for the original bill. That's my understanding of it.
The amendment is in each of your files for Senate Bill 915, or it should be.
This bill talks, Mr. Kronstam, about limiting liability not only for a device but also for people who are taking part in rescue. Do you have people saying when this tragedy occurred, did people say they didn't want to go out because they might be liable?
No, that didn't happen. But in the broad sweep of things, it makes the availability of this best equipment possible. That's the major point.
I'm just trying to get a picture of what the outside boundary of this bill is. So you're mainly interested in the equipment, not in people engaging in rescue. being exempt from liability. Is that right?
Well, both, if possible, but the equipment's the key thing.
If you want both, would you tell us what has happened about people searching in the past? I think you already answered my question. You haven't had people telling you they wouldn't go out and search
No.
because of liability. Okay. That's my question.
Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome, constituent.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. David Hitchcock.
Good afternoon. I'm Dave Hitchcock from Portland. A bit of background, a bit of personal background might be useful before I give my testimony. My professional background is that of engineering and quality assurance. I have worked for Viewmaster in Beaverton for 36 years. Currently, I'm employed as quality control manager, a position which I've held for over 15 years. Previously, I was senior test engineer supervising an engineering test lab. Mountaineering has been a lifelong activity, and I've been a member of various mountaineering rescue groups for over 30 years. As an active member of the Mounted Ski Patrol since 1955, I have been involved in all phases of the patrol, and for the last 3 years have been responsible for the patrol's avalanche rescue training. I am a member of the Mountain Signal Steering Committee, a member of the Equipment Subcommittee, and I chair the Training Subcommittee. Way back in 1976, the Mount Hood Save a Life Fund Committee was busy working on a project evaluating equipment in order to find the best possible communication equipment to be made available to climbers. The equipment was selected and approximately $1,700 was collected. But the project died because no one was willing to loan the radios out or to distribute the radios on a loan basis because of liability fears.
Yeah, Senator Wires.
Mr. Hitchcock, I've read your testimony, and the thing that I don't see in it is what is the real specific technical information about the equipment that now has been tested and found to be the best? How does it work? What did they find out about how often it works and that kind of thing? I don't exactly see that in your written testimony.
We have this is a transmitter that we propose to have issued to climbers. We have a receiver that will locate that transmitter. We received, as my testimony, I deviate from my written testimony, as it says, we received six different units from equipment manufacturers. We tested them all on the mountain in a variety of situations and simulated rescues. The transmitter was buried in the snow, was lowered in the crevasses. The receivers were then, we would give the receiver to a would-be rescuer, and he would go out and find and locate the transmitter. The receivers were used by hand, people walking with helicopters and snowcats. We have tested them as extensively as we can. We are continuing testing them. We will continue to test them to see if there are blind spots on the mountain, and if there are blind spots in the mountain, where we can position the receiver so that we can locate that, or so we can cover that particular portion.
Is that the receiver that's in use in another state, Arizona or somewhere?
That's a receiver that's manufactured in Arizona.
Manufactured in Arizona. Well, is it being used anywhere in the world by human beings? This is a receiver that's being used on whales, is that right?
It has been used for animals. I understand a similar device is being looked into in New Zealand.
Is a device like that being used anywhere in the world on human beings?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't believe so. I'm not aware of. May I ask, Scott? Are you aware of being used anywhere else?
My name is Scott Russell, and I'm co-chairman of the fund. This is the receiving device and as Mr. Hitchcock has indicated, it is used basically for wildlife, and it is used in the scientific community. Some of these scientists are in extremely remote areas to try and track these animals. It is being used by some of those researchers, yes. It has been used in some cases for people in homes that have got various stages of mental dementia, such as Alzheimer's, where they wander off and they can be located. But again, the situation is far removed from a mountain wilderness and the extreme weather conditions that we're talking about. Does that answer
your... Do you think the mountain wilderness is more wilderness than the urban wilderness?
Well,
but, let's leave that for now.
Okay.
The where are they being used for people who have Alzheimer's and dementia?
There is one of these transceivers that was used in Portland by a doctor whose wife had this condition and wandered off. It is not being used on a commercial basis at this point in time. There is a parallel study going on at this time to have such a device for people with mental problems.
Who is the manufacturer? What's the name of the manufacturer?
This particular manufacturer is Telonix, and they're located in Mesa, Arizona. We have received...